Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Facebook was the end-all be-all for a good three-year run.
Yeah.
And now it's Google, it's YouTube, is the leaders in the sort of political ad space, and then it's the, sort of the connected TV.
So streaming is going to have the biggest effect on 2020.
Yes.
This is related to both business and political campaigns, but let's say for a candidate of any type of office, if you poll really strongly among a certain demographic and you poll really weakly among another demographic, which group do you double down on? Where you're weak or where you're strong? Because it's a similar question in business, though. If like a certain group buys my products but another group doesn't,
right,
is my best bang for my buck to raise my profile among the people who don't buy my product?
Well, it depends. You're trying to get to 50 plus one. Mm-hmm. What's the math? What do you need? Every campaign's different. Mm-hmm. So what's the demographic makeup that's going to get you to 50 plus one on election day, right? Mm-hmm. That's all it takes. And you know, it's funny, business marketers do not follow this one. And so the businesses that do have great growth.
What is a mistake that a business marketer does?
Oh, they sit around a table and brainstorm. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd never brainstorm ideas unless I'm looking at data first. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure I could probably come up with some great ideas, but you know what drives me nuts? Like, businesses we work with are like, well, the marketing company said they had a big brainstorming session. Like, found all these great ideas and we implemented them and nothing worked. And I'm like, well, what did the consumer think? Oh, we didn't think about that. So I mean, like, we always say, oh, no, you got to start with the data and then you got to have to follow these five steps. Every business we've worked with has grown and very few business marketers are following. Very few.
And what other issues do you think of in terms of like developing a campaign strategy for either party for 2020?
Get me to guess what Trump would do.
or the Democrats, either one. Okay, Phil Stutz, welcome back to the podcast. You're the online election campaign expert. You've run many online campaigns for many candidates. Who are some of the candidates that you've worked with?
We've done George W. Bush, both elections. We've done U.S. senators, governors. I'm trying to think who would be more recent that you would know. Governor Sununu in New Hampshire. It's an interesting case study. We can kind of walk through how digital is targeting these days, but a lot.
Presidential campaigns? Who are you willing to say?
Yeah, I've done Bobby Jindal. We did a little Marco Rubio. We did a little Ted Cruz. We did a Donald Trump super PAC. I'm trying to think who I've done. Dan Quayle. I was on Dole in 96. I've had plenty of losses. But we did, we were part of Cruz's team in Iowa last year. So that was, as we head into the Iowa caucuses, that was kind of a good win for us because we beat Trump at the time.
And, you know, one thing you explained to me, and I think this was outside of the podcast, you had a really nice history of how 2004 presidential campaigns used online, how it was different from 2008, then yep. 2012, then 2016, and what could be 2020. Just real as a quick intro, what's kind of the evolution of presidential campaigns specifically using online?
Yeah, and I'd even go back and say this. There's this sort of stereotype of political marketers as the guys that do ragtag advertisements and campaigns and, you know, nothing like a corporate ad or anything like that. And really, I think the world kind of shifted in 2004.
Oh, by the way, before you do this, the purpose of this podcast is we're going to kind of figure out who's going to win in 2020, or at least play around with the math that you keep uncovering.
Yeah.
But okay, now
okay,
2004.
Okay, good. Yeah. And so really, I think the shift, there was a complete diametrical shift in 2004. And why it's important is that we've talked about this. There's a, you know, everybody, it's very stereotypical to say disruption is coming into the world. But we see more disruption in politics way before the corporate world gets there. So like Trump was the most massive disruption that had ever occurred in the history of American politics. And it's sort of the kind of like, I always tell our corporate clients, like in 4, 8, 10 years, this is gonna be your business, your industry, right? It really started in 2004. And what happened in 2004 was, this was the first time in the history of an American political campaign that the political marketers were using consumer data and matched it up against voter data. So voter data is, James, you're registered to vote in New York. The state of New York gives us all the registered voters, people that vote. We know whether you vote in primaries, general elections, both, whatever. And then and previously to 2004, that's the only data we ever used to target voters to get out to vote on election day.
You would target Democrats who vote locally or target Republicans.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Men.
Yeah. Primaries. You would only target primary voters. You know, those types of things. In 2004. We came up with a model where we used consumer data. Now, this is 04, so for your audience that's online now, this sounds laughable, but this was a very innovative moment in history, in political marketing history, which was we could find out what subscriptions people had to magazines. We could find out what their purchases were from credit cards, and then we could match that with the voter data and then go to those voters and talk about those issues that we knew they cared about.
So for instance, if a Republican or if a Democrat was subscribed to a gun magazine, you could maybe focus on
maybe that would be a person that you could switch over to your side.
And 2004 was it was Bush versus John Kerry, right?
Correct.
So you would you maybe would target John Kerry voters, and again, John Kerry feels like this on guns. Bush.
Yeah, it's a really good point. What we did in that election was something counterintuitive to every other election I'd ever worked on, which was in every other election I ever worked on, we always go after the high propensity voters. And we want to make, they're going to vote, so we got to make sure they vote. So we advertise to them, we push them to the polls. In that particular campaign in 04, and I was the national Get Out the Vote director for the Bush campaign and the Republican National Committee, but we actually went after the low propensity voters and use this data to try to motivate them to vote, right? You're always trying to motivate, but these were the low propensity voters or swing voters, right? And really why this is so important is that it was the first time that data was used in such a, very dynamic way in political campaigns. It was data-driven political campaign. It was the first of its kind.
So let me try to figure this out. So these people who maybe they're registered, but they just haven't voted in the past 5 elections, but you know what issues are important to them based on their consumer data.
Right.
And you can say, listen, this is the election for this issue. Here's why.
Yes.
And then that gets them to
correct.
Some percentage of them will now vote.
You could do that. Back then, it really wasn't online, right? So it was through mail, because you could mail directly to that person on that issue. Mm-hmm. It could be a phone call, because back then you could make automated calls and a bunch of other kind of calls, because people had hard lines back then. And then door knocking. We would send teams out to door knock. And then on election day, we would turn people out to vote. You know, once we had advertised them, then we would find out whether we had swung them into our bucket. And if they had come into our bucket, then we would turn them out to vote.
And did it work?
Well, Bush won, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and my point was that was the most disruptive moment in political marketing history, because it was used data for the first time from consumer and voter data were combined into one. And until 2008, when Obama combined sort of social media. And there wasn't a lot of targeting there at the time, but it was social media. But the same data we had, but he also used it from, you know, on social media, right? And so that, obviously, he was the most disruptive campaign that had ever run, because he was the first African-American president. So that was an incredible moment. But it was data and social media. And again, most disruptive moment in political campaign history was literally 4 years later, until...
Well, so 2004, yeah. Consumer data plus voter data, but you were using a lot of offline methods.
Right.
So this is where data plays a front row seat for the first time. Now, 2008, social media is combined with that. How did he make use of consumer data, voter data, and social media all together?
Right. He used consumer data and voter data to do the same kind of offline targeting we did. The only difference was that with the emergence of social media platforms, you still couldn't use data to really target that much. You could a little bit, but it was very generic, very broad. So it was but he used it to get momentum to build his brand, right? To use these offline mechanisms that would really work.
Like, what would be an ad that he used on social media that maybe he wouldn't have that was sort of innovative?
I mean, I just can't remember. I just don't know.
You're saying that basically he used social media more than the other candidates just to build up the brand, to say, hey, I'm with the millennials, I'm with the young people.
Right, it's a movement. He used social media to make a movement, right?
Right.
And so
the other...
There still wasn't... The social media platform didn't have the technology to target into voter bases, target individual voters like you can now. It just didn't exist.
And you're saying like John McCain just didn't use social media in 2008. Like he just wasn't active there.
They didn't do much.
Yeah.
Right.
And there, by then there was already like probably 100 million social media users.
Yeah. Right. But they didn't utilize it. And think about it. Like our customer base, voter base is really old, mm-hmm. right? And both, like you can say Democrats have younger voters, but really young voters have not voted in high propensities in the past. Mm-hmm. Even today, they still haven't. They can say they're all excited and motivated, but the data says they still don't vote. Mm-hmm. But back in 2008, with the emergence of Facebook and Twitter and everything like that, old people weren't on that. They weren't on it. So the Obama campaign used it to sort of create a movement that then swung a lot of, you know, soccer moms, middle, I'd say like 35 to 55-year-old voters into their column over time. So they used it in the most effective manner that had ever been done in a political campaign. And then, you know, and then I say in 8 years later,
or 4 years later, 2012.
Nope, same thing. The targeting was a little bit better on social media, but they basically did the same thing.
But given Obama's success in 2008, why didn't Mitt Romney step up his game?
They did.
For social media.
They did. You got to understand, though, Obama started running for re-election the day after he won the first election. Mm-hmm. So he had unlimited resources to run for re-election. It's the same thing Trump's doing right now. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney got in a long, drawn-out primary that ended in the spring, and he basically had 7-8 months to run a presidential campaign that already had a four-year head start on him. And really, if you think about it, the first campaign laid the foundation, so it was like a 5-6-year head start. They did the best they could with the tools they had, but this is the problem with a lot of challengers coming into these campaigns when we talk about 2020, is that they're running other races right now. They're not targeting Republicans or swing voters. They're targeting primary voters on the Democratic side right now, right? Trump's been trying to win re-election since the day after the election in 2016. So that's the advantage of incumbency.
So 2012, no new real innovations, maybe a little bit more targeting.
Yeah, right. And a popular president, obviously.
Yeah. And then, okay, 2016. What happened?
That's again became the most disruptive moment in modern political campaign history, because Trump really the ability to take consumer and all the data that we just talked about, marry it on social media platforms where the targeting is was completely insane. And by the way, that doesn't exist almost anymore. What we could do in 16, because they've pulled the reins back.
What targeting could you do then that you can't do now?
I'll tell you in a second. And then he combined it all with branding, Make America Great Again. It was the greatest branding campaign that had ever existed. And so when you combine the branding, the targeting, and the ability, or the data and the ability to target on social media, it was the most innovative, disruptive campaign that's ever been run. Whether you like the guy or not, that's what it was.
How did he use the branding combined with the targeting? Like, wasn't the brand just the brand for everybody?
Yeah, but then they reinforced it on all the platforms, right? So with Facebook, here's how it used to work. And I mean, there's a part of it that works now, but I'll kind of get into how it works now. But 16, you could literally take that voter file that I told you about, right? And you could overlay it on Facebook's platform. And I could run ads that only went to the segmented voters that I wanted to go after. So if I said, women 45 to 65, I know in Cuyahoga County in Ohio that they care about this issue. I can run ads just to those registered or habitual voters in that particular county to that particular segment. I mean, you could go even more granular than that. The fact is you, in the old days, you would run one TV ad, it'd be all over the country. And now I can segment so down to the person in very efficient manner, you know, whether in whatever campaign we're on.
So like if you were to use one word to describe the big innovation, would you say it was hyper-local, or like what would you say is the big innovation in 2016 that happened? Because Obama
social
was,
media platforms was still using let branding. Us in on everything. Mm-hmm. And it was unregulated and it was the Wild West. So we could target so precisely to voters based on what we knew they cared about. And if you think about it, we've talked to this a lot before, this is kind of the approach that we don't see a lot in corporate marketing now, because people just like to talk about their companies or their service or their product, but they never say, this is what our customers love. Like in politics, everything I've ever done since I got into politics in 1996 has been about what do the voters think? And we got to target the voters. We got to figure out what the voters care about. So then with the emergence of these platforms and then the ability for them to allow us to go deep and granular into their platform to be able to target those voters, man, it was like a panacea for us, because for the first time ever, it was like, this is the ultimate targeting right here.
So what was an example ad you could do in 2016
sure.
that you wouldn't even thought about in 2012?
Oh, God, man. So you could, and the Trump folks did this, they would run one ad on one message, and they'd run maybe 130 different variations of it, different colors. Maybe they'd move one word around. They'd have different pictures. They'd test the hell out of it. And then what Facebook would do is 10 of those would be on fire. And then Facebook would put lighter fluid on it for free. And then the campaign would put money in it. And then they'd just go after it because it engaged so many people.
So all that testing was automated somehow?
What's that?
All that testing, like let's try. Yeah. So
right, you're getting you're getting real time feedback on a daily basis or hourly basis.
What about in terms of the hyper local stuff? Like one message would go to this county in mm-hmm. Ohio, but another message would go to this sure. county in Alabama. Would you do stuff like that?
Yeah, but we did stuff like that in the mail 20 years ago. So mm-hmm. In my brain, like, oh yeah, this is what we've always done. It's just a different way of doing it, and it's the same thing now. Like, so in 2020, I would even tell you, Facebook sucks now. Mm-hmm. Like, it may be good for the consumer, mm-hmm. but from a marketer standpoint, I just don't, there's just not much value. It takes, you know, weeks or months to onboard a particular candidate they want to run. They have to work through all these hoops. Facebook is basically indicating they don't want to, they don't really care about persuasion campaigns anymore. So a candidate that wants to get a message out to try to convince a voter. The Facebook is a very good tool right now to raise money and get volunteers into people that are already supporting you. But it's not a good tool to sort of convince new voters or swing voters to come into the process.
So like basically candidate, you still have the voter data and you would just target the people who are likely to vote for you and say, hey, give us money.
Raise money.
Yeah. But you can't do like, oh, I'm going to target this county because they're more pro this and the candidate is pro. So we
I mean, it's a branding. You mm-hmm. can go out in there and do a lot more branding, but Facebook has just put so many it's you know, it's kind of like they're punishing the bad actors and everybody gets punished.
So what's going to happen in 2020 to online campaigning?
So it's all going into streaming. And here's why it's so mean.
Streaming like YouTube?
Like Hulu and yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, YouTube is number one platform. Mm-hmm. YouTube's far surpassed Facebook in my mm-hmm. opinion. Because everything is optimized to video because that's where the consumer eyeballs are going or voter eyeballs. And so what we're seeing now, oh man, I was just talking to someone about this the other day, but like so these TV companies that make TV, Samsung, Vizio, they are collecting data on you and then they're giving it to us. Mm-hmm. You know, Hulu, you know, Roku TV, Pluto, like all these other apps and streaming, the streaming service apps, they're collecting the data and then we're getting it. So what we're able to do is and we've done this for clients, but let's say a bad ad runs on the NBC nightly news. I'll stay on the Democratic side for a second. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard ad or a hard story on Elizabeth Warren. Right, the NBC nightly news does a terrible story for Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. The Warren campaign can find out everybody that watched the NBC nightly news on the streaming services because the TV companies and the apps will give us that data. Mm-hmm. And then they can turn around and create a counter ad to that story and only deliver it to the people that watched the NBC nightly news.
How would they deliver it?
And they can deliver it on the streaming, and because we got their IP address, we can then go into all their devices.
So how do you go into their devices? Like, what would you advertise on? Like
anywhere that they're following, you know.
Like a web page? Like, they go, let's say they check CNN.com, they could see the Elizabeth Warren.
Right, because you have it's IP targeted. So
and who would you make the deal with? Google AdSense that advertises on CNN.com? Or like, what platform would you use to buy your...
We have partners that we work with on that.
A bunch of like ad partners.
So that's how insane it is right now. So let me go back to this. Facebook was the end-all be-all for a good three-year run.
Yeah.
And now it's Google, it's YouTube, is the leaders in the sort of political ad space, and then it's the sort of the connected TV.
But here's what I don't understand. Like, Hulu, I never see an ad when I look at Hulu or Netflix or Amazon.
Sure. Well, with Hulu, it's live TV.
So do a lot of people watch live TV on Hulu?
Well, I do because I like sports. Uh-huh. So I have Hulu and so you're not just watching $45 a month cable. So I can get live.
You're not watching like your cable channel or whatever?
I don't have cable.
So you're just OTT. You're just over the top.
Correct.
And Hulu's how you watch news and sports.
Right.
Do you think a large part of how do people watch local news?
How
do people watch local news?
Through the streaming services. Now, is it the majority? No. The cable companies still have probably 50, 60% of the market, but it's 30, 40% right now.
Wow. That's a lot.
It's a lot.
And they're watching it through Hulu, PlayStation. Where are they watching it?
Yeah, that's right. That's it.
And then I guess you're able to advertise back on Hulu and all these places.
Right,
YouTube
but I mean, I can advertise on their phone if they watched a particular show on a story or an ad was run and we found out the ad was run on that and during, you know, live newscast. We can then, you know, run one of our counter ads against it.
And so apps also, you can advertise on apps on the phone, mm-hmm. things like that. So probably app
it's
ad
IP
targeting.
Address, so you can do anything.
Yeah.
Because it's their IP that has their, you know, it's sort of like their fingerprint. Their internet fingerprint on the house that they live in.
So streaming is going to have the biggest effect on 2020.
Yes.
So, okay. So I love that. I love that evolution.
And by the way, traditional ads. TV is still important. Radio is still important.
Mm-hmm. But without any targeting, just like general?
I mean, you can target on TV and radio. You can get demo breakdowns and all that kind of stuff. Is it as effective as connected TV, you know, or over-the-top stuff? No, but it's still effective.
So this is a random question. Let's say you pull, this is related to both business and political campaigns, but let's say for a candidate of any type of office, if you poll really strongly among a certain demographic and you poll really weakly among another demographic, which group do you double down on? Where you're weak or where you're strong?
Because this is talking about for a candidate or an issue.
A candidate. So a candidate marketing to a demographic. So let's say someone polls really strong among African-American men and doesn't poll really strong among white women. Should they try to advertise more for white women or African-American men?
I don't,
like you, do you double down where you're strong or where you're weak?
I think I don't know if the question works. So can I back it up?
Yeah. Because it's a similar question in business, though. If like a certain group buys my products but another group doesn't,
right.
Is my best bang for my buck to raise my profile among the people who don't buy my product?
Well, it depends. You're trying to get to 50 plus one. Mm-hmm. So what's the math? Mm-hmm. What do you need? Every campaign's different. Mm-hmm. So what's the demographic makeup that's going to get you to 50 plus one on election day, right? Mm-hmm. That's all it takes. And, you know, sometimes when you go after constituencies that you don't have a high threshold with or you're weak with, they never get your ads anyway. So they're more apt to come your way and they're dying for someone to say, yeah, I'm like that too. Mm. So you don't want to absolutely ignore it, but you have to figure out who you're gonna target. So what I'm saying is the math, it just depends. Every campaign is completely different. What you got to do is, you know, it's interesting. I identified this 5-step process we use in political campaigns, marketing campaigns, and it's you get the data on your voters first, and you've got to design the campaign around that. Really, I always tell a candidate when I'm working with them, like, what do you care about first? And then they'll tell me like 10 things. And then we'll go poll the district, right? And then the district will find out that, oh, they're in alignment on 2 or 3 issues. Well, that's all we're going to talk about. And then we build sort of step 2 is you build a marketing campaign around it. Step 3, you create the brand all around what the voter wants. Again, it all comes back to the voter, right? And then step 4 is you start testing all the messages. And I'll give you a great example. We did work for Governor Sununu in New Hampshire in 2018. And this was a Republican running for reelection in a bad year for Republicans to be running, period, especially in the Northeast. And he was running against a woman, which was the year of the woman too. Mm-hmm. So, and she was Democrat, obviously. So, you know, we were facing an uphill battle, we thought. And the data told us, and this goes back to your question, the data told us through a lot of, you know, we took all this data, consumer data and voter data, and it told us that lower taxes were very important to the constituency in New Hampshire. That makes sense. Like, you know, they're live free or die is their motto. But so we tested a bunch of ads, and what we found was we had very stark differences between 2 voter groups, men and women. We didn't know, that was interesting. And so in the testing process, this fourth step that we always go through, we found out that women wanted to hear about the tax cuts, but how they affected other people's lives in a positive way. Men just wanted the damn tax cuts. Like, they're just like, no, just want more money in my pocket. So what we ended up doing, and we did a big case study, we just ran different ads to those different segments. And Sununu ended up winning by 8 points.
So what was like an ad to, what did it look like, one of your ads to women?
Oh, it told an individual story of a person that had been affected by the tax cuts.
So like
in a family.
So like, oh, taxes were cut for me and I was able to support my older parents with that extra money and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, something to that effect.
And it worked.
Yeah, the case study's on our website. You can go watch the ad. I think it's on there.
And before we get into 2020, one final question was just, what's the role of negative ads or voter suppression and all this stuff?
Well, not voter suppression, but negative ads. But real quick, on that Sununu thing, the 5th step was, now that we found out what really resonated with both sets of voters, then we were all in. So that was step 5, which is, now that you know it works, you go all in. And you know, it's funny, with our business marketers do not follow this formula. And so the businesses that do have great growth.
What do businesses do when they make mistakes?
What's that?
What is a mistake that a business marketer does?
Oh, geez. They sit around a table and brainstorm. Mm-hmm. Like, I never brainstorm ideas unless I'm looking at data first. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure I could probably come up with some great ideas, but you know what drives me nuts is, like, businesses we work with are like, well, the marketing company said they had a big brainstorming session and they found all these great ideas and we implemented them and nothing worked. And I'm like, well, what did the consumer think? Oh, we didn't think about that. So, I mean, like, we always say, oh, no, you got to start with the data and then you got to have to follow these 5 steps. Every business we've worked with has grown, and very few business marketers are following that. Very few. Hmm. It's been a fascinating to see. Look, everybody in political marketing, James, does this. If I'm running against a campaign, I have a Republican and I'm running against a Democrat, they follow the same 5-step process. Hmm. If I'm doing 2 Republicans in a primary and I've got one candidate and I'm running against another, they follow the same process. because it makes you innovate every second of the day. It makes you accountable every second of the day.
I suppose also it's extremely outcome oriented. It's not like our sales up quarter over quarter. It's like we need to win on this one day.
Correct.
And then the entire business is shut down.
Yes.
So
right. Right. We have election day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's weird. No one is doing this in business marketing.
So negative ads.
Yeah.
Where's the role that plays, you know, in all of this?
Well, I mean, you'll see this. So if we want to kind of jump in, you know, you can see in, you know, I don't know when this is going to come out, but like Iowa, you know, is going to be the caucuses, right? And right now you've got Warren, you've got Biden on top. They're going to, the lesser candidates, whether it's Klobuchar, whether it's Kamala Harris, whether it's Pete Buttigieg, I can't believe I said all those names properly, you know, or it's going to be Biden or Warren. They're all going to come after each other at some point. Like the reason Cory Booker, if he's in the race when this comes out or not, I don't know, but he's been savaging Biden for months now because he's behind, and this is a telltale. Usually you go negative when you're behind and you're trying to make up the difference. You know, we've said this in the last time I was on the podcast, like we do negative ads because they work. That's just the bottom line. They work. And in politics, we're completely savages about it because
Booker has been using them and he's been kind of going down.
But you know why? The counter to that is Pete Buttigieg has actually done really well. Why? Because I think people see through the inauthenticity of Booker at this point. Hmm. Whereas with Buttigieg, he comes off very authentic. In a way, it's why Andrew Yang is still in the race, because he does come off different and outlier and authentic. But I mean, Booker's been running for president since he was mayor of Newark.
Yeah.
So everybody sees that, and it, you know, and he's changed his positions 100 times to fit what he wants to ultimately be, which is president. And therefore, the voters kind of see through that.
So when have you seen like negative ads work, for instance?
Well, every campaign I've ever worked on.
Like, what's a good example?
I mean, look, a great example is 2016. And I don't even know if it was a negative ad that Trump ran, but obviously Low Energy Jeb, right? He tagged all these nicknames for all these candidates, which was huge.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know. I've done thousands of them. So, I mean, I can tell you that do they always work? No. But the reason you do is because at a certain point in the campaign, you need a little juice. And the only way you're going to get it is to draw a distinct difference between you and the other candidate. Ultimately, it's all about emotion. You're just trying to draw more people to make a bigger connection to you in the campaign so that you can win.
So, and then the final question before we start analyzing 2020.
Okay.
What's the role of voter suppression ads? And what are those?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
You wouldn't try to like suppress the vote?
I know.
Oh, okay.
I swear. No, this isn't like some PC thing. Like, I just don't even know what that is. Like,
okay, maybe
people
it's,
love
maybe it's
to
nothing.
Claim it on both sides.
Uh-huh.
But I'm yet to understand what they're talking about. Like, look, I lived in South Dakota for a year and worked on a U.S. Senate race. And on the Indian reservations, we heard, they were, you know, sending, you know, on the Indian reservations, they were able to vote 6 times in one day and all that stuff. And, you know, and then so we would send election lawyers in to make sure that really wasn't happening. Is that suppression or is that responding to something that we heard? Neither happened. Everything was fine. But I mean, you hear this all the time. I on the suppression ads, I don't know. There have been nefarious characters that have done like phone calls like, hey, the election's on November 12th. We know, and the election's like on November 8th. But is that what you're like?
No, I would just hear this, that voter suppression was a big deal, but maybe it's not.
I don't know.
So okay, 2020. What's the math? What's your take on the whole Democratic primaries?
Well, I can give
and
you an honest
election.
Assessment of the Democrats because I'm not working for any of them, so I don't have any invested interest, right? Look, 43% of candidates that win Iowa win the nomination on Democratic side. I think it's 50% for Republicans. So Iowa is the most critical. Everybody sees these national polls and they think, oh, who's up? Who's down? Is Biden up? Like, It really isn't about that. It's about Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada to a certain extent, because that's in between New Hampshire and South Carolina.
I don't know how they when the lineup is. Like, California for a long time was one
of the
last.
It's Super Tuesday, I think.
March 3rd. But like, it seems like whoever's polling in California now, that has nothing to do with who's going to be polling in California next May.
No, California poll just came out the other day, and the news media grabs it and runs with it. They don't check the methodology. They don't check anything, right? So, but they just run with the story because they're trying to get clicks. And then people buy it, and then people go around going, oh, well, Kamala's not doing good in California. And she may not be. I don't know.
I feel like Iowa, though, is a weird election to judge on because It's a caucus versus
an election. Gathering.
So yeah, so it's like this big party where everybody raises their hand as opposed to going to a polling booth and voting.
But the media doesn't play it that way on election night.
But like a lot of people, you need a different type of infrastructure to campaign in Iowa, right? Mm-hmm. So like someone like, let's just use it as an example, Andrew Yang, he's not necessarily going to have the political machine infrastructure. He doesn't know the party bosses. Yep. He knows people, so he can go door to door in New Hampshire, but going door to door in Iowa makes no sense. So
let's break that down. So you've got the ground game is extremely important. In 2008, Hillary had a 10-point lead in Iowa in October before the caucuses, just a couple months later. Like the caucus was like January 3rd then. So 2 months for election, she had a 10-point lead. I think a week before the Iowa caucuses in 2008, there was one poll that had John Edwards up by 1 point. I mean, think about that. Hmm. And then Obama wins, right? So then you go to New Hampshire. Well, in 2008, Obama was winning New Hampshire almost the entire for almost the entire year. Then he wins Iowa. Well, your thought process is, oh, okay, well, he's going to win New Hampshire now. And then Hillary was winning New Hampshire most of the whole year. And then Obama took the lead in New Hampshire like 2 days before the vote because he'd won Iowa. He got that momentum. But then the New Hampshire voters swung back to Hillary. So she ended up winning New Hampshire. And then they went to South Carolina, where 3 months before South Carolina in 2008, Hillary had a 24-point lead over Obama. On primary day in South Carolina in 2008, Obama won by 20 points. It was a 44-point swing. Think about that. So, like, everybody that's saying they know right now, they don't know, right? What I try to do is you've got these top-tier candidates, which are Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden and Bernie. Bernie feels like he's got a ceiling and a floor, and it's the same number, but he's at about, 11, 12%, right? And then you've got these sort of second tier candidates. And then this goes to the question we were talking about with Andrew Yang. Who has infrastructure in that state that could make a run? Because Iowans love the underdog. And to me, it feels like Pete Buttigieg. It just does.
In Iowa.
He's been there for a long time. Like he and Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar are the sort of, in a little bit of Cory Booker, if he's still around. I don't know how much longer he's going to be around. But they're kind of all second tier. But really, if you're going to get momentum, you got to have some kind of infrastructure there. Buttigieg has that. Kamala has come in and said she's going to live in Iowa until the caucuses. It's just hard to see how she makes a difference. So what will be interesting to see is do Bernie, Warren, and Biden punch each other in the face for the next 3 months? And Buttigieg stays, punch free, and he kind of comes up the middle and scores. Like, all you need to do is get in the top three and you can move on.
If you're outside
the top three, you're done.
What kind of voter votes in the Iowa caucus? Because again, you have to be a little bit more active than the average voter.
Yeah,
you're
white
going
and liberal.
To a meeting.
White and liberal.
And so, like, I feel like Joe Biden has name recognition among the average newspaper reader, but does he have the people who are going to go to the caucuses? I mean, I guess he's got to be heavy in the political machine because he was vice president.
Right.
He's run for president like 5 times. So what's...
Yeah, the question is, Warren, I looked at some really good caucus polling numbers the other night. Warren, amongst caucus goers, has like 75% favorables amongst all caucus goers. That is by far and away the largest number.
What's
there
Biden's
is.
Number there?
I think 67. Mm-hmm. But Buttigieg is with 69, even though he's polling at 10%, and everybody else is, or the other, you know, Biden and Warren are in the 20s, and Bernie is in third right now. So there's a lot of potential for Buttigieg.
So if you were to give him advice right now about how he could campaign there, what would you say?
I think they're doing the right thing. He's just staying authentic to him. So he's doing like a McCain bus tour right now everywhere, and he's telling reporters they can ask him anything, anytime, kind of like McCain did in 2000. Mm-hmm. And that kind of authenticity plays really well with the reporters. It could also hurt him if he screws up. They'll come after him, but the reporters will. But
what about like...
What does he got to lose right now?
Like Biden being kind of the front runner, everybody is sort of aiming at him, including the media. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of...
They're coming to Warren now.
Yeah.
They'll start hitting Warren now.
But like with Biden, they come out after just the way he speaks, because he's 79 years old. He's getting a little older. He hasn't always been the most lucid speaker in general. It's famous for his gaffes. Mm-hmm. Do you think, even though he's the front runner, and even though people are largely aware of this, do you think that could become an issue where he just implodes?
Yes. 100%.
Why hasn't it already happened, actually?
Well, because I think people are scared to death. Look, the number one issue right now is amongst Democratic voters is anybody to beat Trump. Like, that's number one. And so they think Biden can win. The key this whole race, I'm talking about the general election between Trump, is working whites. That's it. It's the key the whole election. Where do the working white voter go?
So for these fringe states like Michigan,
Ohio. The Democrats can't win without working whites, and the Republicans can't win without working whites. So where do they, it's just that slight shift either way. So Biden, obviously, the voters know he has the opportunity to get working white voters. He just does, the blue collar white worker, the Reagan Republicans, right? The people that switched. This is the same people that voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump. So what happens to them? And they know Biden is the most electable, but the most electable doesn't always win. In fact, they often don't win.
So like at this point in prior elections, have you ever seen a candidate? I mean, Joe Biden's got a pretty imposing lead. I guess you could say in 2008, Hillary Clinton had an imposing lead, and then kind of it didn't work out for her. Mm-hmm. Obama pulled ahead. What other election could you think of where some candidate had a huge lead and then just self-destructed? 1972, Edmund Muskie, Democrat.
Well, I mean, George H.W. Bush had a 91% approval rating in 1991.
Yeah.
And in 1992, he lost to Bill Clinton.
But I'm thinking just in the primaries.
Oh, in the primaries. I'd have to...
Gary Hart in 1984.
Yeah, I remember well.
That or 1988.
He got a little scandal, and that's probably what brought him down. But he wasn't like a massive front runner. Listen... Biden is already losing ground. Warren is now up in Iowa. Uh-huh. And I have friends of mine that are crazy liberals in New Hampshire, and they say, Philip, you go to one of his rallies, and you walk out of there and go, oh boy, we're in trouble. Because he is nonsensical half the time. And they're like, he just can't connect his thoughts. And by the way, like from an empathetic standpoint, he's 76. And he's trying to run for president. Like, I would never do something like that.
Yeah, why is he doing that?
I have
that?
A hard time connecting my thoughts now. I couldn't imagine in 31 years.
And so in New Hampshire, but again, you're saying a lot of it depends on what happens in Iowa. And so this is part of the reason why someone like Andrew Yang, who seems to have a lot of enthusiasm behind his campaign, he probably can't campaign at all in Iowa, really. So he's focusing so much on New Hampshire. What's going to happen is to the enthusiasm behind him when people see the Iowa results. You think that goes down?
In New Hampshire, not necessarily. It doesn't always happen, but it's going to be a hard road for him. I think he's banking on the fact that New Hampshireans are very, sort of independent in their thinking. They don't want to just do what Iowa says, right? But there is a momentum sweep that comes out of Iowa. And there's a momentum sweep that comes out of New Hampshire, and it literally will narrow the field down to two or three. And then it's really game on to Super Tuesday, which is in early March.
And what states are in Super Tuesday?
Oh, I'd have to look at the list. It's a lot, but it's
a lot of southern
California,
states.
Yeah, the southern states.
So California used to be in June, but now you're saying it's in March.
I'm 99% sure, yeah.
And so let's say Elizabeth
New York's not until like the end of March. So it'd be interesting to see if there's two. In a way, and let's say, Warren just did this mass rally in New York and 20,000 people came. I mean, maybe that plays a little bit if she's still in there in March. I mean, there's a calculation to that rally she had recently.
Oh, she had a rally here in New York City?
20,000 people came.
Where was it?
I don't.
I didn't see that. I didn't.
Union Square, Washington Square. Washington Square
a lot of people. So, okay, what other calls, what other things are you seeing in the Democratic campaign that are interesting?
So I think African-Americans are the key in the Democratic campaign. Mm-hmm. So Bernie has never polled well with African-Americans, mm-hmm. ever. And so South Carolina is going to be the real battleground for African-American votes. And if you look at the polling right now, Biden, because of his history and his vice presidency, is polling really, really, really well with African Americans. So it would take a lot for him to get knocked down. People, what we're also seeing in both of these states are they like the policies of Elizabeth Warren, but maybe she's a little off-putting. Now, this is what some of these in-state polls are saying. So it's just a crazy dynamic. I don't know. And Cory Booker came out the other day and said, if Kamala or I don't make it very far, that means we've got, three old white people at the top of the ticket. And it's true. It's crazy. I mean, you've got the most woke voter base that has ever existed on the Democratic side, and they're going to nominate an old white person.
Yeah, but let's say they nominate Biden. Don't you think he'll, who do you think is a likely, like Kamala Harris is probably a likely VP candidate for him, for anybody really.
Oh, for sure. 100%. That's what would happen.
But if Elizabeth Warren won, who is going to be her? Maybe Cory Booker would be her VP candidate.
Maybe. So. Or Kamala. If you think about it, have two women on the ticket. That's probably what she'd do, something like that.
Yeah, just to kind of really stand out or differentiate.
It'd be smart.
Okay, now just in terms of the electoral math, what does it look like going into the general election?
So I would tell you right now it's 248 to 248. And you got to get to 271. So the key states are going to, right now, everything can change. We're a long way from election day. I would look at it as Arizona, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
Arizona?
It's got 11 electoral votes. Wisconsin's got 10 electoral votes. And Pennsylvania's got 20 electoral votes. Those are not
you said working whites. I always think of Michigan, yep. And Ohio.
Right. Michigan is trending Democratic right now. So
it was Republican in 2016.
It was. And it still can swing in the next, 12, 15 months. But that's what it is right now. Somebody has got if you've got 248, and those are three states that are complete toss-ups right now, then somebody's got to win two of them. Now, Trump could win a couple states. He's going to try to win a couple states he lost in 16. New Hampshire, which I think has 4 electoral votes. He was in New Mexico recently, which has got 5 electoral votes. And they're saying they're going to go after Minnesota because Minnesota's got 57% of the voting populations are working whites. And I think they would make a play there possibly as well. They tried to make a play at the end of the campaign.
Oh, that's been typically hugely
crazy.
They've had socialist senators.
Correct. I think they have to see how Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Arizona turn out.
So in your 248 versus 248, are you putting Michigan and Ohio in the Democrat category?
Michigan is, it would be a lean. I mean, it's not in a toss-up, but right now, and Ohio is way Republican.
So you put in your 248 versus 248, you're trying to put
Ohio and Wisconsin, I think it's something like 61 or 57% working whites in both states. But I mean, you look at Ohio and Florida, and they've swung clearly to Trump.
So in your 248 to 248, you've counted all this, but you're saying Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, those are the critical battlegrounds where
mm-hmm. right now
they could go either way. Mm-hmm. And if either candidate dominates those three states, it moves that 248 to 280 something, yep. And then it's enough.
Right. Now, there are other states that could come into that swing. So there could be, like we talked about, Michigan, New Hampshire, maybe Nevada could all come in and come into the swing at some point. But right now, they're on the outer edges.
And what other issues do you think of in terms of developing a campaign strategy for either party for 2020?
You're trying to get me to guess what Trump would do?
or the Democrats, either one.
I mean, you've got to win working class whites. You just have to, right? So I would see the Democrats trying to appeal to working class whites is, hey, we haven't forgotten you. Uh-huh. Because that was what clearly appealed last time. I think Trump will stay hard on his base and try to get the majority based on the way he's campaigned since he announced.
What do you think of his tariff strategy now? Is that obviously, to your point earlier, he's been running for re-election ever since he got elected. So clearly all these policies are him aiming towards November 2020. So does he take this tariffs and say, you know, and he's been focusing so much on steel and parts for cars. Yeah. This affects Ohio and Michigan. Do you think he goes into those states and say, look, this is how we helped you and whatever?
Well, I mean, it's the tariffs have already affected farmers in Iowa, mm-hmm. you know, and so Iowa could go into, I mean, Iowa clearly went for Trump in 16, but it's on the edge right now. It leans Trump, but the tariffs could be a big issue. You know, it's interesting. On the, let's say the China tariffs, have mm-hmm. you heard any Democrat complain about this?
I guess they criticize him for starting a trade war. That's where I hear the Democrats speaking about.
Right. But they've pretty much haven't said much. I mean, even George Soros came out the other day and said, this is right there. Mm. This is a, you know, national security threat at this point. Mm. So it's hard for the Democrats if they know that let's just take China for one example. They know that the China tariffs are the right thing to do. It's hard for them to run against that in these states, mm-hmm. right? Because that's where it's affected a lot, I think, with Iowa, soybeans, things like that. So on the other ones, the other tariffs, yeah, I mean, it's absolutely going to be an issue, 100%. Mm-hmm. You know, he said he was going to bring, you know, he has, like, look, there are a lot of jobs right now. The economy is still booming, but they're going to play it hard.
Has there ever been a situation where the economy was booming and the incumbent lost? Mm-mm. I'm trying to think.
I mean, the most famous one's Bill Clinton, who, you know, ran for re-election on the booming economy. And, you know, Carville basically said, you know, back in 92, it's the economy stupid because it was so poor.
Yeah. Reagan in 84.
No, and, you know, again, you see this in all the polling we see within various campaigns we're working on right now. Everybody's happy. I mean, you probably know this too. Like, go try to find good quality working labor right now. It's hard.
And what other issues do you see being a factor in 2020?
Oh, it's going to be personality. Mm. I mean, you've got
that's it.
Think about what the media is dying. The dying media, right, is what they need to make more money. I'm dead serious. This isn't like any kind of conspiracy. Like, the media needs to make money, so they're going to create controversy, and it's going to be around the brands of either candidate, mostly Trump.
As opposed to the issues.
Of course.
Yeah.
Issues don't get ratings. Do you think people want to talk about tariffs on CNN?
No.
Or Fox?
No.
No. There's never any talk of this. What does it mean?
I want to talk about it.
Thank you, Steve.
So as you get, you're going to do, obviously you're going to be involved in the national campaign. Are you going to do local stuff as well?
Yeah, I mean, we've got races all over the country right now. It was an interesting dynamic. The oxygen sucks so much life out of political campaigns, where in the last few years, candidates, let's say the, you know, in 2014, 2016, after those campaigns ended, the next day our phones were ringing off the hook with candidates saying, I want to run now, I want to run. And after 2018, and then the presidential campaign's kicking in, everybody's just sitting on the bench right now from, you know, jumping out. And there's a, you know, on the Senate side, there's just a lot of races out there that people just want to be quiet right now and let these candidates suck the air out of them. But soon it's all ramping up. So I always said after Labor Day, it would just go nuts, and it kind of has.
All right. Well, Phil Stutz, thanks for handicapping the 2020 election. Come back in a couple of months for Bachelor Primaries. Yeah, let's keep covering the 2020 election. I love the game-like aspects of all this stuff. So it's fascinating. And
I mean, if you like math and puzzles, the Electoral College is the most fun you can play with.
Yeah, where do people find your white papers on all this stuff and your book and everything?
Yeah, philipstutz.com is sort of where you can find me. And then the political marketing agency is Go Big Media, and the corporate marketing agency is Win Big Media.
And you have white papers and stuff like that?
Yeah, we have case studies on a lot of this stuff.
And title of the book?
Fire Them Now.
Fire Them Now.
Seven Lies Digital Marketers Sell.
Excellent. All right, Phil, thanks so much. This was so informative, and I can't wait to see what happens next.
Thanks, man.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.